I'm Jonathan Bastian. This week on KCRW's Life Examined, when it comes to describing some of life's most profound experiences, like death and grief, words often fail us. But a poem, letter, or piece of prose can speak volumes.
And by now, I was crying hard, and I was kissing my father's face again and again, telling him I loved him again and again. It was the softest face in the world, my father's face. So quiet like that. I never knew it. I had never touched it before.
And later, a writer discovers solace and hope through poetry.
With suicide particularly, where there's this shame around it, poetry became really steadying to me. I didn't have to be poems that reference suicide, but to see poets being able to speak of those experiences, that was really steadying and illuminating to me.
Grief, the language of loss, and the healing power of the written word. That's coming up on Life Examined. Artists, poets, and writers have long explored the human condition. And within this is the very complicated and universal feeling of grief. And when we struggle to find words, articulate our feelings, it's often a poem, a note, or piece of writing that has the power to illuminate, to heal, and to reframe the unspeakable into beauty and hope. When I last spoke with poet and essayist Ross Gay almost a year ago, he touched on his own experience with grief, which he wrote about in his collection of poems called Inciting Joy. If you caught that conversation, Gay talks about the joys of gardening and pickup basketball. It was just a fun conversation. In fact, I'm proud to say that that podcast won us an award from the LA Press Club. What struck me then was the poignancy with which Gay talked about the experience of losing his father. He'd spent 6 months with his dad before he eventually succumbed to cancer. And as Gay struggled to come to terms with his own experience, writing became the vehicle through which he processed his sorrow and honored the person he loved. So how do we process grief? And can poetry and prose help us navigate through those dark days? I wanted to explore that further, so we reached back out. Ross Gay is a poet, essayist, and professor of English at Indiana University. Ross Gay, welcome back to Life Examined.
Thank you very much. I'm glad to be with you again.
You know, we had a chance last year, to talk about something that I found really moving, which is that, you know, in your recent collection, you talk about the death of your father, which was something that I found just very moving and personal. And for those that hadn't heard that interview, I wonder if you could just take us back to that period of your life and, you know, what was happening with your father and you. It was a really important time.
Yeah, it was just, you know, my father was diagnosed with liver cancer probably kind of in January or December, something like that. And he very quickly got sick, and, you know, May 10th he died. But it happened that I was able to, I was coaching basketball, kind of working on a PhD, and I was sort of mobile. So I was able to just move in and, you know, take care of my dad for the last, you know, 5 months or whatever of his life.
Hmm. Were you guys particularly close? Was this kind of strained? Was it natural? What was that like for you?
You know, we were super close, but we also had a difficult relationship. Mm. I think we had a difficult relationship in part because we were very close, but maybe like each other too. But, you know, we butted heads. We had long periods of sort of just just barely talking to each other. Uh-huh. I mean, you know, like in retrospect, it's just so silly and everything. But we loved each other like crazy. And one of the things that I like to say is that, you know, I was a difficult child. and, you know, and my dad was a complicated person. Just in the older I get, of course, the more I understand some of those complications, not only because I see them in me, but because I just understand that we're complicated. Mm. But even when we could just barely talk, you know, to one another, if I was in his proximity, he would automatically sort of have his hand on my head, like kind of rubbing my hair, you know, he couldn't not do that. So it just feels like, yeah, we could be very strained, but, you know, we love the hell out of each other too.
So then what was it like for you? I mean, you're a thoughtful guy, you're a writer, you're a poet. What was it like for you to just be around your father as you knew that maybe these were some of the final months? Hmm.
Many things, I think. I think one of the things is that it felt, it felt sort of important and obvious in a certain kind of way. Like, this is, I'm able to do this, I'm going to do this. I think in some way, even as it was going on, I think it did feel reparative. Like, I do feel like I understood that I was doing something that was useful to our, important to our relationship, that had not just been like a sort of easygoing relationship. And at the same time, I think I was, in a way, like sort of overwhelmed by other things too, like overwhelmed by a kind of, I don't know, fear or anticipation of grief, of not, I don't even know how to articulate it, but I think like I was aware of certain feelings and I'm aware that I was unaware or repressing other feelings, you know? And among those things were probably, you know, the understanding that, oh, everything's going to change here soon, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, there's an interesting term that sometimes, you know, I've used when I've done grief counseling called anticipatory grief, totally. Right? Does that word kind of resonate with you, even just when I say it?
Yeah, to some extent, though I don't know that was, maybe it was more like, you know, the, when you refuse, there was some thing, and I feel like this was an ongoing thing after my father died too, like a sort of refusal to sort of also acknowledge, you know, we never talked about the fact that my dad might be dead here, you know, like that, you know, that was just not, there was a sort of sense of like, well, maybe.
Yeah.
And all of that is very deep and complicated, you know, the various sort of stories to that story. But I think there was a little bit of a way, and I kind of get into this in the essay in the book, where I sort of, not that I would, I don't know what I would have done had I been like, okay, so you are actually going to die on May 10th. Should we say explicitly, talk explicitly about our heartbreaks, or like what we love more than we can even come close, or what you would like to know about me? I don't know that would have happened, but it's sort of, but it wasn't even like sort of on the table to be like, okay, so it is actually like 4 months to go. So what are we thinking here?
Yeah.
You know?
I think that's really interesting. And I think I share that feeling or that experience, which is that, you know, when you're about to lose someone, you almost cling to this one story or belief that they still might live somehow. Right? Even though you know it's probably not going to happen, that there's this, it almost feels like it's this animal sense in us, this thing that, you know, we just really don't want to, you know, go deep into the darkness, which can also be full of love and beauty too. Do you know what I'm saying?
Absolutely. And that's sort of like part of the story of that essay, is that like my dad was really, he was really on his way, you know, he was really on his way. And me and my brother like get out of the room where he is one night, and we're like, man, he's so weak, like we got to get him better. And I have this whole fantasy that I'm gonna, like, you know, because I'm kind of a coach, like I was coaching at the time, and I'm like, you know, I know how to train, and I'm like, I'm gonna get this guy better, you know, because I'm just, and it's going to be real slow because he's really weak, and but like we can we can overcome this thing. And it's this incredibly full fantasy that was not going to come to pass.
Maybe there is some kind of, I mean, I say this with some sensitivity, sometimes like an arrogance of a somebody who shows up as a caretaker, like, don't worry, I got it.
Oh, totally.
I can handle it from here, you know?
Totally. Yeah. And just a kind of like naiveness, a kind of sweet naiveness, but also, you know, like a kind of like, yeah, we can get this.
Yeah. So then, I mean, how did it feel when you watched him begin to decline? How was that for you?
It was many things, you know. It was, I had this dream where I was in an airplane, and it's very sort of shaky. This is after he died, and it's very shaky. And it's, you know, the feeling is like, oh, this airplane's going down. And then I see my father in the front seat, look back, and he's flying the plane. And then I'm suddenly like, calm. It's like, it's okay. It's going to be okay. And to some extent, like, that like I said, we had a complicated, rich relationship. But there is an element, there was an element of that with my dad. Like, he, you know, I felt very safe. And when he got so that, you know, he couldn't open a bottle of water, or he couldn't, you know, walk across the room, that was sort of, you know, that was sort of devastating. And it was, that was, and probably, and it's terrifying, you know?
Mm. Yeah.
And heartbreaking to, you know, how it is to see someone you love just be, just to see their body sort of losing the capacities by which you know them, but also to know that they're also in a good deal of pain. That's devastating.
So talk about then the experience of then losing him kind of fully and officially. And then that, I think, is perhaps, you know, when we think about traditionally a sense of grief settling in, can you talk about that transition of what you experienced and what you felt along the way?
You know, the truth is, I feel like I was doing a lot of work not to feel this sorrow of my father's dying, and also the sorrow, you know, my own sorrow and my mother's sorrow. I think I was trying very hard to avoid, yeah, feeling it, and so there were ways that I could kind of intellectualize it, I think, and I could kind of talk about the fact of his no longer being here with us, but I was really terrified to sort of, I think, you know, it's a thing that I sort of think about in my life generally, but I learned it, I think, with my father, that witnessing my own sorrow was terrifying, and being close to my mother's sorrow was also terrifying. You know, and that feels actually as important in a way to my experience of it in terms of a kind of revelation, like, oh, if you can't be close to your sorrow, then you're going to miss your life.
Mm. Can you say a little bit more about that revelation? That seems really important to me.
Well, I mean, I can say, like, plainly, and I write about this in the book, like, I remember being in a mindfulness meditation class at Thomas Jefferson Hospital. And I was like I was having a hard time. And I would not have sort of connected explicitly to my father's death. And it was many things, but that was among them. And I remember watching this interaction between the teacher and one of the students in the class. There were about 30 students in the class. And we were doing this very simple meditation technique called a body scan.
Yeah.
And we did it together. And the teacher said in a very sort of nice teacherly way, how'd it feel? And most people were like, oh, it felt good. And this one woman said, I didn't like it. And she said, well, why didn't you like it? And she said, I'm not sure. And then the teacher, again, being a good teacher, was like, do you mind if we kind of stay with this for a second? And this woman said, yeah, let's do it. And they kind of like hung around with it for a little bit. And then she said, oh, I feel sad. It makes me feel sad. And, you know, she started crying a little bit, and they're kind of like doing that. And like, and I noticed myself unable to look at them, and it felt like brutal. It felt like a brutality that we would be all like sort of required to witness this woman being a little bit sad. And I also recognized that the feeling in my body as I was watching them, or no, the feeling in my body as I was not watching them was precisely the feeling in my body when I would go to visit my mother after my dad had died. And it was a feel like I wasn't able to take a deep breath, put it like that, you know, like it was sort of a crushing feeling that I endured, you know, because of course I was going to go hang out with my mom, but it also was like, how do I get out of this?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I know you've written and talked about this too, but there's a certain an aspect, and I don't know if it's just wrapped up in the idea of masculinity, but that there is a sense that we should avoid or not allow ourselves to be overtaken by something like sorrow or pain or grief. Right.
Yeah, I think so. And And I was just on a, having a conversation. I was on a conversation with like this with Sharon Salzberg, and I was like excited. She's a Buddhist teacher, and I was excited mm-hmm. because I was like,
yeah, she's been on the show.
Oh yeah, cool. And I was like, you know, you say, I was sort of like, what do you think? You know, sort of about your very question. And she was like, right. One of the things that, like, it's sort of, it's crucial not to refuse our sorrow. And there's this other thing of like, well, we can kind of like disappear in it, be completely overwhelmed by it. And we were sort of talking about that, and I was sort of wondering if it's the case that if we understand that we are not alone in sorrow, if that might be some way that we do not, that we might be completely devastated and forever devastated, but we might not sort of become isolated in our sorrow or mm-hmm. something like that. Mm-hmm. You know, I was just sort of wondering that. And I do think that's a big question, because I think you're right. We're often sort of, you know, we're told to get over it. Move on. Mm-hmm. And it just, that to me is just like, not only is it brutal, it's just like, well, it's just not true. You know, you don't, you know, we change our relationship to things with this and that, but I don't think you really get over who you love, you know?
No, and I'm taken by the idea of being kind of swallowed up by an emotion that we almost can't even name sometimes.
Yeah.
Right? It's just like, you're just suddenly being slammed by something like a wave, and you're not even sure what the word is to really get to it.
Yeah.
And it seems to me that if one can find the language and then understand that that language is spoken by others around you that are in that place too, I mean, that to me has such just a profound healing function to it.
Me too. Me too. Absolutely. Yeah. I think in so many of our experiences that are like overwhelming experiences, I haven't thought of it until you were just saying that, that they often, part of the overwhelm is that, I think, is that we think of them as, this is only mine. Mm. You know, I think of like other kinds of emotional crisis, you know, like, I don't know if this is like sound pedagogy, but every once in a while I'll be in my class, I'll be like, how many of you have had like, panic attacks or whatever, something that when you have a thing like that, a certain kind of crisis, you can feel like I am the only person in the world experiencing this. And if I tell anyone, I'm going to be sent away.
Right. They think I'm crazy.
They think I'm crazy. Uh-huh. And then like, you know, half of the class raises and everyone kind of like rests a little bit like, oh, okay. Like, how do you deal with that? You know, and whatever. But I think grief is very much a similar way. I feel like one of the reasons we probably refuse grief is because it can feel like isolating. But I think, I wonder too sometimes if we refuse grief because it reminds us, in fact, that we are connected to each other fundamentally. Mm. You know, like you don't grieve if you're not connected.
Right. Yeah, I mean, in some sense, right, grief is this kind of beautiful but shadow side of love, isn't it?
Absolutely. Yeah, exactly. And I would even say that maybe it's not a shadow side. Mm-hmm. Maybe it's like, it's as much the light as is the love, you know? Yeah. Like they're not sides of each other. They are each other.
I wonder too, when you watched your father in his final days, I mean, was there anything about the process of dying that surprised you? I mean, maybe sometimes those that haven't been through it might think of it almost as kind of a seamless process. Mm. But my experience losing my mother and a number of people in my lives is that death kind of arrives at its own time, not in a very romantic moment, generally speaking. And it's pretty wild in many sense.
Yeah, it's really wild. It's sort of, there are all kinds of, it definitely was sort of, you know, it was kind of a brutal hospital style death, you know, where he was intubated for a while, you know, when I say a while, like longer than like a day. And you know, you kind of get to encounter or consider those things too. Like, how do I want to leave? But But it was very much where this sort of you know, my uncle, my dad's brother, his baby brother, is a physician, is an oncologist, and was sort of around, you know, was sort of involved to some extent with like, and he was the one who, you know, took the tube out of my father's mouth. Mm. It's just all those things where you sort of, my dad's mom was there, you know, all these things where I was sort of thinking, man, we're all having a profound experience right now, you know, as tied up as I was in my own head, I was like, damn, I'm my father's son, but I'm not his brother. As much as I feel like I know my dad, that dude lived his whole life with my dad.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
There's a section from the essay that I'd love for you to read. Can you tell us kind of what this is and give it to us?
Yeah. This is, I mentioned that fantasy where I sort of thought, you know, me and my brother were sort of witnessing how kind of weak my dad was getting, and we were like, we gotta kind of get him to bounce back, you know, and we gotta get him on the treadmill.
Yeah.
There would be no treadmill, but we were hoping for the treadmill. And basically, I sort of tell the story about I was on my way to work, and then it was like, we got to get to it now. And I head down to the hospital where my dad was and where he died, a hospital called Mercy in West Philadelphia. And, you know, I got into the room, and the last thing basically that he said was like, my kidneys are failing, and they were taking him out. And I just kept asking, can I get in to see him? Where they were setting him up. And when they finally said I could go see him and walk me into my father's room, it was nearly silent. No Judge Judy, no ESPN, no TV at all. Just the quiet whir of the dialysis machine against the wall, plugged into my father, who was on his back and looked to be sleeping. His mouth and eyes were softly closed. He was breathing quietly. The blanket was pulled over his chest, and his hands were at his side. I think the animal knew that it was official now. I had had my last conversation with my father. This part was over now. And I remember feeling frantic, trapped, as I kept asking him if he could hear me. My hand was on his chest. I was shaking him just a little, asking if he could hear me. Dad, can you hear me? And he stayed sleeping, quietly. Can you hear me, Dad? Can you hear me? And by now I was crying hard, and I was kissing my father's face again and again, telling him I loved him again and again. It was the softest face in the world, my father's face. Hmm. So quiet like that. I never knew it. I had never touched it before. I was crying onto his eyelids and cheeks and kissing him and telling him again and again I loved him. I love you, Dad. His brown face was lit with my tears. And with my forehead pressed into his and my hands on his cheeks, I noticed that my father had freckles sprinkled across the bridge of his nose and his upper cheeks. It was like a gentle broadcast of carrot seeds blending into his skin, flickering visible from this distance. It was through my tears I saw my father was a garden, or the two of us, or the all of us. Not here long, maybe, it is. And from that, what might grow?
That was beautiful. And Ross, I wonder how it was for you just to read that again. Like, what was coming up for you? I mean, that is really powerful.
I do. I sort of like think of like one of the, as I was reading that, I was sort of thinking, oh, one of the sorrows of this, I think of just experience, you know, like we live, we lose, you know, our beloveds die. And I do think it's a sort of probably common experience to be like, oh, I never even noticed this thing about you. I'd never touched your face like this, or I never noticed you had freckles, or I never noticed that's what you did every time after you laughed, or I never noticed, you know. And that, I think it is like one of those things, like it both feels heartbreaking, and part of the heartbreak is like, maybe the instruction of the heartbreak is to be like, And today you have the opportunity to sort of notice what people do when they laugh, and to notice how people tie their shoes, and to notice how people smile, and, you know, whatever.
Yeah, and I think, you know, my experience is maybe similar as I think a lot of ours is at that moment, which is just that when the person has really fully died, I mean, there is this like deep atavistic kind of primal thing that comes out, you know, this like animal scream almost. And it sounds like that's where you found yourself as well. That there was just, there was something just potent that was coming out at that point for you.
Yeah, totally. Totally. Yeah. And it was sort of the understanding about, an understanding above understanding, you know, and it was sort of like, I wasn't thinking about it, but I think I was, because that wasn't the thing. The thing was like, oh yeah, he's just getting his dialysis now. But I think that understanding over understanding was sort of like, yeah, I think this thing is wrapping up, you know, and that did, you're absolutely right. It felt very true.
Yeah. So, I mean, I wonder, and I know this is maybe too big of a question, but like, how now do you think or define grief after having been through this? What kind of words do you put to that word, which I think is can be so big at times?
I do wonder, and I feel like I must have lifted this from someone. You know, I feel like most of how I think about this is informed by other thinkers. And I feel like there's something like, maybe something like grief is the way that we metabolize change, you know, and it's sort of sometimes that maybe happens over a little bit of time, and sometimes maybe it happens, or maybe you don't stop metabolizing change. And maybe it's not all change either. Like, I'm not real precise on that, but I do feel like there is, you know, there is this profound thing. Like, and it wasn't actually, you know, partly I think what sort of, there's a way that the sort of refused grief that I write about in this book, which was a kind of, you know, sort of bent me toward like being like really kind of disturbed. And it felt like part of what I was sort of refusing to witness, maybe, or to fall into, because it felt so terrifying, is that, you know, when who you love dies, who you understand your life, yourself to be, dies, like every single thing changes, you know? And I feel like I learned that by witnessing other people experiencing that loss and being able to be like, oh, I see. Like, you now, like riding your bike is no longer the same. You know, like going to the record store is no longer the same. You know, preparing your tea in the morning it's a different thing now. And being able to sort of, as I was sort of getting in touch to some extent with that, you know, to the best of my ability, which is ongoing with that feeling, to be with my mother, to be like, oh, every single thing in your life has become like, really, like, you know, pretty much, they were very tied up, my mom and my dad. Like, every single thing, like every meal you cook for the rest of your life is going to be a different thing. You know? Not like it's going to be a less thing or a more thing or a, you know, a bad thing or a good thing, but it's going to be a different thing.
And it's interesting, right? I think maybe you're similar to me, which is there's some days you think, oh, I can kind of just exist alone in this world. I'm fine. I can do the things that I care about and my passions. And but what you're saying is like almost mysterious and metaphysical, which is that like these interpersonal relationships have a massive impact on who we are and how we exist in the world, right? I mean, you maybe might not have spoken to your father for a week or months on end, but like that death shifted your reality of what it is to be a human that wakes up and exists every day.
Completely.
And I find that to be like really, really important and kind of profound.
Yeah, profound. It's profound because I think we can't exist alone or isolated. Even when we imagine ourselves alone, we're with, you know, whether we're with, you know, like the sun or the trees or like the ground beneath our feet. But we're also like in the case of like, if I felt like I was annoyed with my father, I was in relationship with my father. you know, if I felt like I was sort of like trying to like get him out of my, if I was trying to like, you know, whatever, I was not talking to my dad for something or whatever. I was in relationship with my father, you know, and it's sort of like that. To me, the thing that, you're exactly right, I feel like one of the lessons of my life, an ongoing lesson, is that there's a part of me that wants to be alone.
Yeah.
And it imagines that being alone is safe. You know, and by being alone, meaning being out of relationship. And more sad is being out of obligation or being out of like beholdenness. You know, like I don't, you know, to be outside of relationship, you know, to be alone means you don't have to mourn. You know, it also means you don't have to like, whatever, contend with oneself a little bit. You don't have to listen. You don't have to do. But at the same time, that fantasy of being alone or that fantasy of, you know, being self-sustaining is precisely a fantasy. And it's a kind of brutal fantasy as far as I'm concerned, too, because the things that we'll do to sort of imagine that that's possible, we'll just sort of like, how do you put it, outsource our needs.
Yeah.
You know? So I feel like grief is this kind of place where we get to sort of be like, oh, right. I love stuff, you know? Mm-hmm. I have the capacity to love, which means I have the capacity to be devastated. I have the capacity to like not be able to get out of my bed for weeks because I don't know what this thing is now that this person I love, just whatever, or whatever, you know, that I have the capacity to be moved, actually. Mm-hmm. Moved is a good word.
Yeah, I love that. Well, as we begin to kind of wrap up, there was an image in the piece that you presented in which you talked about your father's face as if there were carrot seeds over.
Yeah.
And I love that because not only is it a really striking image, but I have to ask you about your connection to the fact that you love planting gardens. You love seeing things grow. You love being outside and touching seeds with your hands. And I'm wondering about your connection between, you know, the death of your father, but also of rebirth and of kind of like the fundamental rule of the world, which are that things continue to come back in ways that are mysterious and wonderful and beautiful too. So I just, as an open question, where do you kind of see these connections of death, but also of life and plants and seeds and things coming back?
There's so many, and I feel like it's such a lucky thing to kind of get to hang out in a garden because it does sort of encourage you to have a different relationship to things like blooming and to things like going, you know, making seeds and to things like dying or going dormant or maybe primarily things turning into other things, which is always what's happening in a garden. You know, it's a kind of this, by things turning into other things, it's also like this site where you get to see that, oh, isn't that amazing? Like where the peas grew last year, the collards are growing really good right there. It seems like maybe they've left something behind that is making those collards thrive, you know, and you can get into that a little bit of what that means, what that is. But it is an opportunity not only to sort of witness how things are changing into each other, but how things are indispensable to one another, how things are, you know, require each other. Mm. You know, a garden, I say this again and again in the book, like a healthy garden, you know, a garden that is, you know, that we are not at war at, but we are sort of listening to and witnessing, is a place where you get to see stuff working together in all of these sort of miraculous ways and also making each other possible in all these miraculous ways.
Mm. Well, it's been such a great pleasure and honor to have Ross Gay back on the program, the author most recently of Inciting Joy. He's a poet, essayist, and professor of English at Indiana University. Ross, thank you, as always, for spending some time with us.
Same here. It's so fun to talk with you.
And now we'd love to hear from you. Is there a book, a poem, or an essay that helped you through a period of grief? We'd love for you to share that on our Facebook group. You can find a link to that at kcrw.com/lifeexamined. I'm Jonathan Bastian, and this is KCRW. We'll be back after this short break. Stay close. I'm Jonathan Bastian, back with Life Examined on KCRW. So as we continue to reflect this week on our own experiences of grief, how do written words connect us to our deepest emotions and serve as a bridge to healing and recovery? Let's rejoin the conversation and hear from another poet and essayist, Chloe Honam. Born in Auckland, New Zealand, Chloe Honam came to California as a teenager. She's currently assistant professor of creative writing at Baylor University, and her collections of poems include The Tulip Flame and The Lantern Room. Chloe Honam, welcome to Life Examined.
Thank you for having me.
I want to start just hearing about your mother. I mean, I know that you lost her when you were just 17, and I can imagine just what a huge impact that would have on anybody, but of course you, and also being a writer. Tell us a little bit about her and this very devastating news that I know that you would hear. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yes, I can. So she died when I was 17, and she died from suicide. And she was in New Zealand, where I grew up, where I was raised, and where she was born and raised. And so she was in New Zealand, and I had moved to live with my paternal grandmother in Los Angeles. I had moved about 2 years before, and then my mother died, and so it was a mentally devastating, shocking, and I was in Los Angeles. She was in Auckland, New Zealand, and I hadn't been back since I'd moved to Los Angeles, and so it just really altered the course of my life from then on. I have remained in the States mostly, travel back to visit, but live here.
Mm. Yeah. And what did it mean to you knowing that your mother died of suicide versus, an illness, although I think suicide is probably an illness in its own way. I mean, but, that's such still a taboo subject. Mm-hmm. And I know for people who have lost family members through suicide, there can be a lot of shame or unknown or aspects of it. What did that all mean to you?
That taboo of it and shame of it was certainly very present. It was difficult to find language around, and being 17, it was difficult to sort of know how to talk about it with friends and things. There was my family, and then there was also my world of high school and things as well. And it was difficult to talk about. I was very fortunate in that my paternal grandmother, with whom I lived, she was a therapist, and she was enormously helpful and steadying in realizing those taboos and helping to push through them, and realizing that shame and helping to try to lift it. But it was, I wouldn't know how to talk about it. I went off to college, and I had, new friends and new, dorm mates and roommates and things. I went off to New York for college, to sort of new, meeting all new people and things. And I remember at the beginning, I would quite spontaneously, if I was asked about my mother, I would lie. I would say she lives in New Zealand, or and then if she died, I wouldn't say how. I would lie, and it was kind of spontaneous at the time. I think it wasn't as though I decided to do that or planned to do that. It would just be in the moment. It could be difficult just to find the language to tell the truth.
Yeah, and I think in a sense, very few deaths are actually arrive at a time that everybody is ready for. I think that most deaths happen very unexpectedly. Even if someone is ill, it can happen really quickly. But in this case, I mean, I I'd imagine the suddenness of it almost, you know, must have felt like she had just disappeared, not mm-hmm. even to mention the fact that you were on different continents within different seasons too. Mm-hmm. And so I wonder, you know, if there were things that you had wished you could have said to her, or if there could have been things you wish you could have known, because I feel like this was probably all maybe enshrouded in some kind of mysterious quality.
Yes, in my particular experience, she'd had suicide attempts in the past leading up to, and that was one of the big reasons I had moved to live with my grandmother in Los Angeles, was because my mother had a suicide attempt. And we, you know, our family in Auckland were trying to deal with that, you know, in the aftermath of that. She'd had a very serious suicide attempt and then had come home. And at that point, it was sort of decided I would go live with my grandmother for a while. And it was at first sort of to be temporary, just to go for a semester and be away for a while. But it had become very difficult in our house. So, and then we had the distance and sort of, you know, hearing that she was doing better, but always sort of worried about it. And then when she did die, I mean, there was so much I wished I'd been able to talk with her about. And that sort of continues as I grow older and I gather new ways of seeing things or that I wish I could talk with her about. So that, I think, was immediate and also sort of ongoing. Sometimes there'll just be things that happen in the world, or I'll read a book or something, and I really do wish for that chance to speak as adults, because I think there were things I knew and things that I didn't know as well, and things that she, you know, likely didn't want to talk with me about or confide with me, because I was a child, 15 when I left, and things that I wish that we'd been able to talk about now, or, you know, be able to, you know, talk as adults is something I do wish. Yeah.
Well, I know that this would have a big impact on your writing, and in your first book, there's a poem in there called "Come Back," and I'd love it if you could read that for us, and maybe we can talk about it after.
Absolutely. I'd be happy to read it. So this poem, it's a villanelle, which means it has repeated lines, refrains repeated throughout the poem. And it's about looking at horses, which I love horses. I find them so majestic. But within the context of the book, it's also about grief and the kind of disorientation and, you know, vertigo feeling that can come with grief. And I wrote this a while ago now. When I look back on it, I can see the effort to hold an image clearly or see something clearly. So in the context of the book, it's also, you know, about that kind of way of seeing or effort to see clearly. Come back. I can't see all of any horse at once. They weave through twilight, in and out of sight, as the sky drains of color, enters dusk. The barn's a bloodstain on an ivory dress, lost in the skirt, a spiraling red kite. I can't see all of any horse at once. Between us, there is only field and dust, a fence and a shadow fence. Beside me, lightning splashes the hillside, loosens it so dusk can wring each soggy evergreen, unlace pink threads of berries from the shrubs. I wait. I can't see all of any horse at once. The moon has flown, and in its place a husk clings to the sky, the horses figure eight in single file. Through rain-sown drapes of dusk, I try to count them climb up on the fence. Their foreheads shine with pearly stars, ghost-lit. I can't see all of any horse at once. They multiply and shiver in the dusk.
Yeah, thank you for sharing that with us. And You know, when you read it, there was something that felt almost very dreamlike in the quality of it and in the way that the refrain, I can't see all of any horse but once. Can you talk about maybe that refrain there and a little bit of what you were driving at the poem?
Oh, yeah. Well, that line came first, I can't see all of any horse at once. And with a villanelle form, because those lines come back, it's good to have a line that you can kind of deepen or circle and return to. And I think in the context of the book, you know, trying to see clearly, to see the whole picture of something or to hold an image steady was important to me in writing the poem. So I think in having something like that to try to, the effort to see. And so that became centered on the idea of trying to see a horse.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, it's interesting. When I lost my mother when I was 30, so I was still quite a bit older than you, but I remember when that had happened, someone had come up to me afterwards and gave me a hug and said, well, you know, he was about my age, and he said, welcome to the club. You're now you're in here with us, in a sense. And I remember thinking, this is not a club I asked to be a part of, but here I am, right? The story had suddenly taken me to this moment, to this place, to this connection. And I guess I wonder for you as this young person who had envisioned their life moving in one direction, and suddenly, you know, you've come across this thing that had never asked for and that was going to shape so much of you, you know, how you sat with that, how that felt for you to suddenly have to be in the presence of that.
I think I relate to that, you know, what you said about someone saying, you know, welcome to the club, and how now I can see grief as something that connects us, you know, that we're here together and we can be there for one another, and it doesn't have to be so isolating. But at 17, I didn't, you know, I couldn't quite see it that way at that time. But with suicide, particularly where there's this, you know, shame as you mentioned around it, to me it felt like a heavy thing to try to navigate, and that was where things like poetry became really steadying to me to sort of see. It didn't have to be poems that reference suicide particularly. It could be a lot of other taboos as well, but to see poets being able to speak of those experiences was something that was really steadying and illuminating to me.
Mm. Well, speaking of the writing, I'd love to jump to a poem called Offerings. And can you set this one up for us? Talk about, you know, where this poem came from, at what time in your life, and then I'd love to jump into it.
Yes. So this poem I wrote when I was approaching the 17th anniversary of my mother's death, 17 years of my life with her, and then 17 years without, and then going forward from there as the years would continue, it would always be more now life without her than with. And I was just this kind of feeling of a flood of longing with this poem. And that context that I just mentioned is not in the poem itself, but the longing behind it is connected to that anniversary. Offerings. I have saved my pantomime of the sky for you. Let me lie with my head in your lap. I will sing the song of the trees in the cold wind, the way they rush up like flames, their leaves rippling. I want to show you everything you might have missed. With my fingers, I will emulate moonlight resting on a field of violets. I am about as convincing as the child playing the sun in the school recital. But I have rain in my hair. This much is true. Let me bring it to you.
Rain is mentioned in this poem and in other ones, of course, you've written. And, you know, I wonder how much of a theme that is for you. And there's also that, I think, a very mysterious ending line there, which is, I have rain in my hair. And then you say, this much is true, let me bring it to you. Can you tell me about that, those last few sentences?
Yeah, sure. I think it's, you know, so interesting to, after you write a book or you kind of look back at your work from more of a distance than when you're writing it, and rain is all through my work. I have, rain comes up in many, many poems. It's always somehow coming into the poems. It's not intentional that I do that. It just happens. And, you know, I grew up in Auckland, which is a very rainy place. And so that seems where that comes from, you know, to have, just to have so much rain in my memories. So in those lost words there, I have rain in my hair, this much is true, let me bring it to you. You know, bring something of, you know, earthly, something that the, you know, the rain, that wherever she is, I could bring that, anything she might have missed. It sort of holds for me a whole lot of mystery because, you know, of course, with, after someone's death, you feel, where are they? How do I reach them? What could I bring them? So, and the rain being such a sensory, earthly thing, I think that's how that sort of came into those, that lost line.
Mm. Well, it's been really wonderful to spend some time with Chloe Honum, poet and essayist. Her collections include The Tulip Flame and The Lantern Room. Thank you so much for sharing some of your work and your memories with us. I really appreciate the time.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
All right, that's it for this week. Our producer is Andrea Brody. You can connect with us on Facebook or you can find me on Instagram. I'm at Jonathan W. Bastian. You're listening to Life Examined on KCRW. We'll be back next week. Have a wonderful day. We'll see you soon.